Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In his book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero, J.D. Aronson offers a meticulous and illuminating look at how the victims of national disasters are honored on a massive scale while analyzing the recovery, identification, and memorialization of the 2,753 victims of the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks. 1,100 families who have not received identification of their loved ones, and despite the stated best intentions of New York City's Medical Examiner's Office, the process has generated endless debate. Mr. Aronson, who is the founder and director of the Center for Human Rights Science at Carnegie Mellon University, where he's also a professor, joins us now. And later in the show, we will be joined by Sally Riegenhard, one of the leading advocates for the 1,100 families of the victims of the attacks who've never received identification of their loved ones. Hi, Jay. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Your book was published by Harvard University Press in 2016. Has the situation for the families improved over the past 2 years?
I wouldn't say that the situation has improved for anyone affected by this tragedy. There have certainly been a couple of additional identifications over the past 2 years, and that certainly has a big impact on the families that are receiving remains or finding out that their loved one definitely was there. And while I don't think that the old adage that time heals all wounds is totally correct, I would say that the passage of time does allow for people the space to make sense of what's happened to them, and hopefully to begin to put the pieces of their life back together, or if they've had quite a bit of time to begin to integrate this knowledge that they have into their daily lives.
You write that without identification of the loved ones, relatives cannot access financial and social services, dispose of personal property, or seek compensation for their loss. And then they also can be socially marginalized. How would they be socially marginalized? I mean, I understand that all of this would be a major problem for families beyond the fact that they just want to grieve.
So there are multiple facets here. I think at the most basic level, from a legal perspective, when you lose a loved one, there needs to be proof that that person died so that you can bring their will to a conclusion, that you can divide up their belongings among next of kin, that you can go through the process of getting life insurance for them if they had it. You can seek certain services from local and state and federal authorities. And so without proof that the person has died, you can't do any of that. What happened in the World Trade Center situation is that so many people could not be found. The bodies could not be identified at the time. So they actually developed a special process for declaring death without a body. From a more spiritual or psychic perspective, when you're constantly waiting, when you don't know, you sort of enter into a world where you just don't feel like you're a part of society. I think this happens when people are sick. I know it happened to me when my wife and I had our children. You just feel like you're in a different space. And I think the space that you're in when you don't know what happened to a loved one marginalizes you from society. Just being able to go to the supermarket and not have people sort of look at you funny, just to be able to live your daily life. And so in that sense, it is important to be able to say this person has died.
Only 293 bodies were found intact, and almost 22,000 pieces were recovered from the debris. Charles Hirsch, who was the chief medical examiner at the time, said that he'd attempt to identify and return to families, quote, every human body part recovered from the site that was larger than a thumbnail. Was that a promise that was impossible to fulfill?
I would say that the promise was made in a moment of emotion, both in terms of like this was his city and something terrible happened in his city, and also for the nation. This was a traumatic moment for the United States. And so it was about more than just the city or the families. It was about a national response to a tragedy that we at the time had never experienced. And so I think he was saying what he really should have said, I think, is we are going to do everything we possibly can to identify the remains. But he made a promise to families that he would never, or that the city, that the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner would never rest until they had exhausted every possible means of identification. And I think that was a mistake.
Are people still working to identify victims?
Yes, absolutely. So the OCME maintains a repository of unidentified remains within the grounds of the Museum and Memorial at the World Trade Center site. And essentially, anytime a new technology or a new methodology becomes available for doing DNA identification of the kinds of remains that are there, they pull those remains out and test them and do their best to identify them.
You published a book in 2007 about DNA profiling. Wouldn't DNA profiling make it fairly easy to identify the remains, even if they are in fragments?
So the key here, interestingly, is not the science of DNA identification. There are two things that need to happen in order to make a DNA identification. One is that you actually have to be able to extract genetic material from the remains. And if you wanted to destroy DNA, the two best ways of doing it are heat and moisture. And that's exactly what you had at the World Trade Center site. So a great deal of remains have been damaged to the point where it's almost impossible to get DNA, or the technology needs to be developed to get it. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that once you have DNA, it's usually broken up into many fragments, and you often don't have a direct sample for the DNA that you get from the remains. So you need to go to family members, and then you need to begin to do statistical calculations to determine the likelihood that this short stretch of these few markers would match a relative who doesn't share all of the DNA with that other person. So it's the statistics and the methods for getting the DNA out of the remains that are the hardest part.
And the reason the fragments are so small is we're talking about huge buildings with basements, mm-hmm, that all collapsed. When they collapsed, how high was the rubble?
So it was several stories above the ground. It went several stories down into the ground and several stories above. In addition to just the weight of the buildings crushing the everything that was in the way as the buildings collapsed floor by floor, you also have that intense heat of the jet fuel burning, and then the building begins to burn because of a variety of structural and material issues, and you have all of the material that's in the buildings burning. And so you get intense heat, intense pressure, and then the firefighters need to come in and try and put out the fire. So they add water to the mix.
Has the forensic process for identifying remains like that evolved in the 17 years since the attacks?
Absolutely. The evolution of these techniques actually began in the context of the efforts to identify the victims of the Srebrenica massacre in the former Yugoslavia. There were other cases where you had these sorts of remains, and the methods were being developed to deal with those. And it's also important to keep in mind how many remains there were and how many tests to identify a single person you needed to do. So you not only needed to identify each of the remains, or to get a profile from each of the remains, but you also have to go to family members. And often there would be 7, 8, 10 family members per victim. So it was a massive endeavor. So part of it is those techniques. And the other part is just keeping track of all of this genetic information and being able to compare it. So you need to compare the DNA profile of the remains to all of the reference family members that you have.
So it's a rather tedious process and also expensive, I assume.
Yes, it was quite expensive.
You reported 2 years ago that it was up to $80 million. I'm assuming it's higher now.
That's the best estimate that is publicly available, and I could never get anyone from OCME or the city to give me any other number. That was, I believe that was, I don't know exactly when that figure was arrived at, I've actually forgotten, but that was a few years after the event. There's an ongoing effort now. I mentioned that whenever there's a new methodology or a new technique or new tools that become available, OCME, the medical examiner of New York, goes back and retests. And those costs are as far as I know, borne by the city. Initially, the federal government gave money as part of the recovery effort, and that was used to defray much of the cost. Again, I don't know exactly how much of it, but much of the cost of the early effort. And over time, the city has kind of taken on this task. And I don't know how much exactly, but I would say that when a new testing run happens, people have to be pulled off of other projects and other jobs. You have to buy reagents. You have to you have to use the equipment that you have. There's depreciation and all of those things. But I again, I don't know exactly how much it would cost on a kind of per new test basis.
In August 2017, a victim was identified, and his identity was withheld by officials at the family's request. It was the first match in over 2 years. Have there been others since then?
So over the past few years, there have been trickles of new identifications, one of whom, interestingly, was a 26-year-old graduate of Carnegie Mellon. And as I was doing the final edits on the book, this individual was identified. And
was somebody you had been a student?
No, it was not someone who had been a student of me. If he was 26 in 2001, he must have. He was my age. He graduated in 1995, I would assume, give or take, or 96. So he was before I arrived at Carnegie Mellon in 2004. But it was quite amazing. I actually had a few colleagues come up to me and say, you know, I knew Matthew. His name was Matthew. I knew him. He was my student. And it was a kind of profound moment for them to have this person who they knew had died, and then to have him kind of resurface in the news regarding the World Trade Center attacks. And my guess is that's probably why the family that decided to withhold the name did so, because they just didn't want to be brought back into the public space.
On the other hand, a month ago or so, I interviewed a well-known immigration lawyer, and he represented a woman whose husband had died in the World Trade Center debacle, and she was here. She was not an American citizen, mm-hmm. and she was going to be deported because she was here because she was his wife.
Yes,
I assume there are all sorts of complicated stories like that.
Yes, there are. There are actually advocacy groups that are set up to help families who had undocumented loved ones in the World Trade Center at the time of the attacks. So there are quite a few unidentified remains that are being kept in the repository. And one source of those unidentified remains might be people who were never reported. There are two reasons why an individual who died in the World Trade Center attacks may not have been reported. One is that this individual lost contact with their family and friends, and nobody knew they were there, so nobody knew to report them. If you haven't spoken to someone in 10 or 15 years and you don't know where they are, you're not going to say, well, so-and-so left home in California 15 years ago and they might be there. That's just not logical. The other source of those remains could potentially be undocumented workers whose families were afraid to let authorities know that they were there. Now, authorities were pretty clear that they weren't going to use that information against families, and that their goal was to identify all of the victims and to make sure that everyone knew what happened to their loved ones. But when you live in fear, it often prevents you from gaining access to resources that you might need or want.
I'm talking with J.D. Aronson about his book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero, here on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. You begin your book with a very vivid account of the attacks. How did you gather so many first-person accounts from that day?
I spoke to a lot of people who were there at the site shortly after the attacks, or who came to respond in the immediate aftermath. I felt that it was very important for me to have a kind of a visceral sense of what happened, even though I know that that could never replace being there or being there as an early responder. One of the things that someone told me who was there as the first tower collapsed was that the thing that she remembers most is the smell. And that's something that you can't capture. And so I think that that's something that I wanted to at least be able to tell my readers. There are also...
But I just want to interrupt because I used to work in the area, and we were very aware of that smell even way after the time we were allowed to go back to our offices.
I think we just
assumed that it was a smell of burning flesh, but we were reassured by the government that it wasn't. On the other hand, some people were allowed back in their homes. Mm-hmm. It seems now way too soon.
Yeah. So I think that these are the kinds of things that when you write and when you do radio and when you read about things, you can only capture a certain part of the of any given event, and you might miss the essence of the event. But I at least wanted my readers to know those kinds of things. I should say that I also read a ton of transcripts of people who were interviewed in the immediate aftermath.
And you drew upon a lot of the 9/11 literature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my favorite books were those that collected people's stories. I'm not going to recite them here, but I cite them in my in the chapter where I sort of tell the story of 9/11 and the immediate aftermath. But there were great collections of oral histories from people from all walks of life, whether they were people who worked in the buildings, people who lived nearby, or also first responders. There were several collections of those. And I also looked at a few novels or a few kind of fictional accounts of the events. And the one that was really my favorite was a book by Amy Waldman, who was a reporter for the New York Times. And it was called The Submission. And it was sort of a story about what would have happened if the person who won the memorial design competition was Muslim. And the thing that was great about it was that it allowed her to explore the motives and the personalities of the people involved without offending anyone.
You focus mostly on memorialization. As a society and individually, what does it mean to memorialize the dead?
I think it means so many things. I think that as humans, we have a need to respond to death. This is something that's part of all cultures. Every single culture you can think of has a ritual or a process for dealing with death. And they have commonalities, but they're also very different. I think from a kind of social perspective, if we have a situation like this where many people die in an urban space, we have to purify that space somehow by doing something that will allow us to say, this place isn't haunted, or this is a place where something bad happened, but we can now return. And there's also the political side that we need to avenge these deaths. And so I think that all of those things kind of come together in this story.
Well, who owns the dead? The government? The next of kin? In a situation like this?
I think that, again, there are so many factors that come in when you ask a question like that. The most obvious answer is that the families own the remains. By law, the families have a right to dispose of the identifiable remains of the next of kin.
So if bones are found and the DNA proves to be from some family, mm-hmm. the bones are then given to that family?
In almost all cases, there's a very long history of jurisprudence going back further than I know about the history of law, I'm sure, that says that identifiable remains belong to the family. The challenge here is that a large percentage of the remains were unidentifiable and could not be linked to specific individuals who could claim next of kin status.
Or what are called finds, human remains?
Finds were part of the material that was removed from the World Trade Center site as the cleanup was happening and loaded onto trucks or barges and brought to Fresh Kills landfill in Staten Island for processing. The way that things ended up there is that there was machinery brought in to help sift the remains. And so what they would do is they would first take the, often they would actually take the metal beams from that were the structure of the site. They would remove those on World Trade Center site and send those straight for recycling or to be scrapped into new steel. Then they would bring the rest of it to the World Trade Center site, and using a variety of techniques, they would sift that material, and they would essentially separate out everything larger than, say, a quarter of an inch. And anything smaller than a quarter of an inch was sifted and moved to another part of the World Trade Center, of the Staten Island site. It ended up being kind of kept in two mounds. The very early on in the process, it became clear that if there was human remains within those finds, pulverized bone or DNA, it would be impossible to remove that material. There were many people at the site who kind of wanted to ignore that, but even Chuck Hirsch at one point said, listen, we can be fairly certain that there is some human material within those. It was mostly pulverized concrete and stone and the material that was used to build the site and the sidewalks and asphalt and all kinds of things. For the city, it was a disposal problem. How do we get rid of this material and put it somewhere? For the families who were particularly concerned about human remains, that was material that was human in essence and needed to be dealt with in an honorable and in a dignified way.
Are the outcomes for families that receive the remains years or even decades after death different from the ones who knew about it early on?
When you receive remains early on in the mourning process, you're able to bury those remains as part of what I would call a kind of standard model of grief and integrating this knowledge into your life. When you don't receive remains right away, and when you do receive them later, it reopens wounds, but it sometimes allows you to kind of come to I don't say closure. I think anyone who studies these things doesn't use the word closure, but a conclusion about this actually happened. And in other cases, people say, listen, I never received remains, but I know that my loved one died, and the remains don't really change that.
I understand that you live just blocks away from the Tree of Life Synagogue. It's a different situation because the bodies are there. But at the end of your book, you argue against politicizing the deaths of 9/11 victims. Do you feel the same about what's happening in Pittsburgh?
That's a really complicated question, and I think it's something that I'm kind of still working through. One thing that's important to point out here is that the victims of the World Trade Center attacks were targeted, I would say, randomly, rather than for something that they were doing or some group that they belonged to. They happened to work in buildings that had symbolic value, or in the case of first responders, were simply trying to do their jobs in the aftermath. Very few of them had any direct role in the kind of economic or political or military activities that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and their associates profess to despise. The victims of the recent shootings in Pittsburgh, which did occur about a quarter of a mile from my house, three blocks away, a site that I pass every day while I'm walking my dog in the evening, on the other hand, were targeted specifically for their religious affiliation and their identity as Jews. The building was actually chosen as the target because it housed a very progressive congregation that fervently believed in the importance of welcoming and assisting refugees and new immigrants to the United States and to Pittsburgh. The shooter was both an anti-Semite and a white supremacist. And as such, I think the nature of these deaths and the situation has, in a way, forced us to politicize their deaths in the sense that we're actively seeking to counter anti-Semitism, to counter white supremacy, and to counter hateful rhetoric. That includes, in this case, the hateful speech of our president and a significant contingent of his administrators and supporters. One thing that we've actually avoided doing, and I say we in this case because I am part of a group of community members who are, in a sense, politicizing these deaths. I think it's really important that we end this hate, that we recognize that anti-Semitism is part of a broader spectrum of hate. What we haven't talked about is gun control, and I think that's because guns were the manner of death. The gun that he used was the manner of death and not the cause. And right now we're focused on the cause. And so in that sense, we're politicizing that part.
But he had a lot of guns.
He had an AR-15 and other weapons with him. However, the people who were targeted weren't targeted for their beliefs about guns. my guess is that many of them were advocates of gun control. But that's not what we're fighting for here right now.
The U.S. government regarded the 9/11 attacks as an act of aggression by a foreign aggressor and a reason for military action. Has the memory of the victims also been used to justify military activities in the Middle East?
Absolutely. Again, I think it's important to remember that
that might not have gone down well with all the families.
No, many of them disagreed. What's important is that there was a particular aggressor in this case, which was Al-Qaeda, which was being harbored by the government in control of Afghanistan. And I don't think too many of the families, none that I know, were against the military action in Afghanistan. What happened was the Bush administration had a longstanding desire to finish the job of George W. Bush's father, a job that many in his administration and within the Republican Party and within the more militarily aggressive wing of both parties actually thought that we hadn't finished the job and we wanted to go in and get rid of Saddam Hussein. What was illegitimate in this case was using the memories and the bodies of the 9/11 victims to justify a war in Iraq.
The National 9/11 Memorial and Museum opened in May 2014 and keeps the remains of the unknown victims in a space that's separate from the general public but open to scientists and families. Mm-hmm. Has that been a sore point for some of the 9/11 families?
Absolutely. I don't know how many families, but I would say that most of the families that I have spoken to, they tend to be the more outspoken ones, have expressed concerns about this. The issue here is that in the original designs, the memorial and the space where the remains would be kept at the World Trade Center site was completely separate from the museum. But the museum was running way over budget, and there were major debates, quite embarrassing debates, about who was going to pay for all of this. And so an architect and planner, designer was brought in to do value engineering. That was the euphemism that was used. And one of the value engineering decisions that was made was that it didn't make financial sense to keep the memorial and museum separate. So they became one. The memorial is on the surface, the museum is down below, and there's a wall that separates the museum space from the repository. For the families, the wall represents the repository because there's a plaque on this wall that says behind this wall is the remains of the unidentified and unclaimed victims of the World Trade Center attacks. For the families that that have been vocal on this, including Sally Regenhard, who will be on later in the show,
in just a few minutes,
the wall is actually part of the museum. It's an element of the museum. And so that the bodies behind become a kind of draw for tourists and for others who actually pay money to come down into the World Trade Center Museum to see the exhibits.
And when you say pay, do you think it's a problem that the 9/11 Museum charges $24 per visit?
My argument would be that this is this museum ought to be free to the public. This is part of American history. This is a seminal moment in the era that we're living in today. I would say in many ways the problems and challenges that we're facing today are in part a product of the events of 9/11 and how we've responded to them. And I think it's as sacred and as public as any of the museums that are in Washington, D.C. Now, if you go around the country, there are many history museums and civic museums and art museums and natural history museums that are not free to the public. But I think that this one is an exception and should be run in the same way that we run the National History Museum and the National Museum of American History in Washington or other museums on the National Mall.
Do you think that the people who are making the decisions have been sensitive to the process of grief and healing for the victims' families?
I think for the most part they have. I think that many families, again, including Sally Regenhardt and the group that she represents, would disagree. But I do feel that as much as they can and within the context that they're working, the planners of the museum and memorial, not all of them, but the majority have been sensitive to the needs of the families and the desires. I think that when you're dealing with a situation this complex, people are bound to be upset and feel left out and feel like their views aren't being heard. I think that's a natural, normal part of the process. What I think is problematic is that when public input was gathered in the early years after the World Trade Center attacks, in many cases, the requests or the demands or the claims being made by families were kind of just ignored. And so if you're going to ask for public input, I think it behooves you as a representative of government to actually listen to what people are saying. If you're not going to, why go through the farce or the fiction of having all of these events? And they will tell you that we listened to the public and we did these things. But I think they could have done a much better job in that regard.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. To help us understand why the memorialization of the dead in New York City continues to be an issue, we're joined now by Sally Regenhart, one of the leading advocates for the families of the victims of 9/11 attacks and one of the members of the 1,100 families who've never received identification of their loved ones. Sally's 28-year-old son, Christian, who was a probationary firefighter with the Fire Department of New York, died when the World Trade Center collapsed. And she joins us now, along with J.D. Aronson. We've been discussing his book, Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero, which is published by Harvard University Press. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you. Thank you so much for having this very, very important discussion. I greatly appreciate it, and I greatly appreciate Professor Aronson, his work, his superb book, and the fact that it was written in a very even-handed way. As a historian and a scientific person, he's the first person who has really endeavored to tell the story of the horrid struggle that the families have gone through in trying to respect their loved ones and trying to have proper memorialization. So I appreciate both of you for having this opportunity to speak about this matter.
And Jay has written about you in his book, and as you said, he strives to be even-handed, focuses on evidence-based discussions about the attacks. But can I say that you take sides as someone who speaks as an advocate for the victims and families?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
What are you hoping to change?
Well, first of all, we are affirming that human remains do not belong in an admission-charging museum. Human remains need to be memorialized. They need to be memorialized with dignity and respect and honor, and we do not have that situation at Ground Zero. So we want to have these remains brought above ground and put in a proper tomb-like structure akin to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Of course, it would be much, much, much smaller, because these remains, unfortunately, in the words of the medical examiner's office, they're freeze-dried. So they're very, very small. It's not a matter of space. But the most important thing is, you know, as was discussed by Professor Aronson, we do not have a place to go to. Mourners, people who've lost their loved ones, we need a place to go to that has dignity, respect, and honor. And being in the basement of this 9/11 museum, which is basically a tourist trap, an admission-charging museum with thousands and thousands of people and an irreverent atmosphere, that is what we want to change.
Why do you think the city has fought you on this?
Well,
does it go all the way back to Rudy Giuliani and continued on into the current administration?
Well, you know, it certainly happened very early on. You're correct in that. And the thing is, the city decided that instead of really taking in the consideration of the families, their wishes, their rights to be able to memorialize their loved ones' remains and so on, instead of that, they handed it over to a private nonprofit organization, which we believe their main goal is to create tourism on this site.
Jay, is the kind of conflict we're talking about regarding the remains something that's happened before in our history?
I would say that this is the first time, at least in the United States, that we've seen anything quite like this. And I think that That's because there's never been an event like this anywhere like Manhattan.
Well, for example, there was Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, which also collapsed. And I don't know whether all of the bodies in that were found intact.
So I would say, well, I would just say that Oklahoma City and New York City have different resonances in the world and in our popular imagination and in the availability of real estate. I think one of the major things that had to happen in Lower Manhattan was that life had to get back to normal. And the perception among many of the decision makers was that if we make this into a cemetery, then nobody will want to come back.
The EPA declared the area safe to visit way before some people felt it should. Again, for the reasons that we're talking about?
I would say that that federal, state, local officials wanted the country to get back to quote-unquote normal as soon as possible. And by not allowing people to return to one of the busiest, most financially important places in the world, by forcing residents to stay away, that would have sent a message to the perpetrators of this that they actually accomplished something. And there were also, I think, everyone involved in all of the politicians involved in the response were people who had national political ambitions. Giuliani, Bloomberg, and Governor Pataki. They all had their eyes set on being president. And if they could do a good job with this, then they had a pretty clear road, they thought, or they suspected, to the White House.
Sally, what do you think of the way officials have handled finding the remains?
Well, I would like to say that they've done a very poor job, certainly in doing that. The main reason, which Professor Aronson touched upon, is they wanted to get this done. They wanted to open Ground Zero again. They wanted to clean it up. That was their term, which was a very hurtful term. They wanted to clean it up as soon as possible. So instead of allowing governmental agencies to come in, groups of anthropologists who offered to come in and help try to look for these remains in an academic, a scientific manner, creating a grid, a classic approach, they rejected all outside help, and instead they had the firefighters, the heroic firefighters, who very honestly, and many of them will say, they were never trained in the science of trying to find human remains of this type of magnitude. People who were blown to bits, literally, and so on. So, yes, that was the goal of the initial goal, was to clean this up. And what this resulted in was that there were thousands of remains that were just discarded, that were not, they had an inability to control all this. They didn't have the resources. They didn't have the academic people. They just pushed them through it. The pressure was on the fire department. And because of that, so many people were also, exposed to all of these toxic materials and so on, and they're living to pay for it today with their lives. But I just want to touch back on what Professor Aronson said about, the site and how, business has to go back and so on. Families never wanted to stop any rebuilding or progress, but what the system should have done was, while they were doing that, they should have taken the input of the families, they should have taken the wishes, as, Professor Aronson, noted also, but they should have. The difference is that families went through years, and I know, I speak because I was in a part of every single committee, gathering, panel, etc. We spent years discussing, giving our opinions, and then we had that listening to the city farce, where all kinds of people got together, good people of goodwill who wanted to help, and we came with all of these recommendations. Everything that we did recommend was rejected, but we didn't really know. There was a plan that was in place all along that had nothing to do with memorializing the dead the way the families wanted to, the way it should be done. So So we were really betrayed by their system. The other matter is how this is different from, you know, other sites, and certainly the Murrah building with Timothy McVeigh. The unidentified human remains are interred in the state capitol in Oklahoma, and that was with the advice and consent of the families. That's how that was different. So in the other two sites, we have Shanksville and we have the Pentagon. Again, the people who managed this took the input of the families, and it everything was done in the way that the families wanted to do it. Okay. That's the difference.
So, Sally, if I may sort of amplify something, yes. There were two things going on. One is that this is the consequence of the chief medical examiner saying, we'll never rest. You have to keep the remains in a scientifically accessible site. There are many ways of doing this that don't involve the kinds of decisions that were made here. The other thing that I would just want to point out is that in the case of New York, and I think in all of these cases, the people who were making the decisions saw the families as being one stakeholder of many. And the idea was that there were many different groups that had to be pleased, and that we couldn't just listen to exactly what the families wanted us to do, because they were grieving and they were emotional and they weren't thinking long term. And I think that a lot of that kind of just a feeling of almost paternalism towards the families prevented some of the very rational claims that were being made from being listened to. Whereas business owners or the financial industry or the federal government, residents, and tourism were seen as more rational and kind of fact-based things to do planning on.
Where does Norman Siegel come into this dispute?
Well, I can let Sally answer that. Norman came to represent the families. I think Sally can give you a better history of this. But yeah. He perceived that the government was not respecting the rights of the family members to the remains of their loved ones.
And Sally, he saw it as a constitutional matter?
Well, he certainly saw it as a human rights matter. And very early on, you know, he told us that the first and foremost human right is the right to life. And the rights of our children and our loved ones were violated that day. But we went, Norman represented us. Norman is a person who really, it was an intrinsic part of our efforts. All we wanted was to have the right to make a decision as to the final disposition of our loved ones' human remains.
So you have filed a lawsuit.
We filed a lawsuit. We filed a lawsuit.
What are you asking for in the lawsuit?
The only thing we were asking for is to have the right to force the city of New York to send a letter to every single 9/11 family member and ask them, do they support the fact of the human remains being placed in the basement of the 9/11 museum? That's what we wanted. Do they agree with that? Do they disagree with that? And the city of New York has fought us consistently over the last decade. We spent so much time in court. We did not prevail. We went to different courts. We appealed it. And we just feel that the whole process was because the families were not, their dignity, their right to make a decision regarding the human remains of their loved one was not taken into consideration. And I do have to say that this elitist attitude that the families, not by Mr. Aronson, but I'm talking about the system, Mr. Aronson has been extremely respectful in his book, that the system would have the audacity to say families were too emotional and so on. I was part of these family groups. These people were dignified. They were academic people. They were very intelligent. They were rational. And it's an outrage to be characterized that. It's a discrimination. And again, I say, on the other two sites, in the Pentagon site, the Department of Defense worked with the Pentagon families. In Shanksville, the National Park Service administered that site, and everything that was done was in accordance with what the families wanted. And it's not a complicated thing, and we still want this today. We want dignity, respect, and honor for these remains. And the remains can be, there's no scientific investigations done in the basement of the 9/11 Museum.
So,
they have to take it back.
Jay, isn't the basement 70 feet underground in a flood zone?
Yes, it is. And during the construction, during Hurricane Sandy, there was flooding in the space.
So that would have affected the remains, wouldn't it?
The way that the remains are stored, they're actually they're not only freeze dried; they've been desiccated, but they're also stored in vacuum sealed bags. So, no, in that case, it wouldn't. But I think certainly from a perspective of dignity, you don't want a repository flooding in that way. I just wanted to add one of the really big challenges that Sally was talking about is that there was a question about not only who owns the dead, but who represents the families of the dead. And Sally and her colleagues saw themselves as representing a particular faction or a particular viewpoint, and they wanted to know how big this faction was. It was impossible to know because the families were spread so far across the world, essentially. There was an active, you know, there was a majority in this area, but all over the world. And they, one of the things that they wanted to do was they wanted to find out how many people agreed with them. But because their particular desires were not those of the decision makers essentially decided not to ask the questions that they wanted, that Sally and her colleagues wanted to ask. And
Sally, you wanted contact information.
Sally wanted to, I mean, if I may speak for her, Sally wanted to just be able to pull the next of kin of all of the victims to find out whether they agreed with this plan that had been many years in the making and that had evolved many times, and that the original plans that had been made were not the ones that we ended up with. To know, is this final plan that you have acceptable? And the people who were in charge of the memorial in the museum said, listen, we've had many, many public fora, we've asked for comments, we have people on our board. And there was a dispute among families about whether the people who were on the board of the memorial and museum actually represented the majority of families.
And Sally, you have called them the Memorial Industrial Complex?
Right. Yes, I have. I just wanted to clarify that we, because the city of New York and the chief medical examiner's office absolutely refused to do any type of survey of the families, which they had an obligation to do, the families themselves, we created an online survey. Mr. Bill Doyle, who unfortunately has been deceased recently, he had the largest amount of contact information, email contact, of family members. He headed another family group. His son was also remains missing at the World Trade Center site. He surveyed all of the 9/11 families that he had, you know, addresses. And the results of his survey, which we worked with, and Norman Siegel collated the results of, the results were 94.5% of the people who answered this survey did not agree with having the remains of their loved ones in the basement of the museum. However, again, the city of New York, they just disregarded our survey, and that's why we went to court and we stayed in court and we kept on appealing this, because we feel and we still feel, and we're not going to give up on this, the family should have the right to decide, do they want their loved ones in the basement of what's essentially a tourist trap and admission charging museum, or do they want it above ground? The only way that we can get the proper kind of dignity and respect and honor is to have the National Park Service assume control just of the plaza. The museum can do what they want to. Control the plaza, make it a dignified memorial site, just like they have in Washington, D.C., and let it be a place with a small tomb, a patriotic, decent, above ground, so it's not going to, all these remains aren't going to wash away in the next flood, which will happen. That's what we want, and we're going to continue. And we met with the course, we used to meet with the Bloomberg administration, and we met with the de Blasio administration on October 3rd. We told them what we want. We told them what needs to be done. We're waiting for them to answer us. If we don't get any type of opportunity to have something decent done at Ground Zero, we're going to go to the governor, Cuomo, and then we're going to go on the federal level. We won't stop. We won't give up.
And your group is called the World Trade Center Families for a Proper Burial?
Excuse me?
And your group is called the World Trade Center
Families? No. Our group is called Respect Human Remains at the 911memorial.com.
Is there a why? Oh, so that's the website?
That's the website. And as Professor Aronson noted, my organization is called 9/11 Parents and Families of Firefighters and World Trade Center Victims. And that's the group that, you know, helped Mr. Doyle administer this survey. And it's not eye-opening to us. Would anyone want their child, would anyone want their loved one, their remains to be taken away from, take your rights away and put them in an admission charging museum? They are part of the tourist trap of Ground Zero. It is immoral. I feel it's illegal, but of course I'm not an attorney. Our wonderful Norman Siegel has gone through all these legal procedures, and I know he'll be with us till the end. I do want to say, as a Catholic person with a very strong Jewish background, I wrote personally to Cardinal Dolan, and I appealed to him in 2011 to meet with certain members of my group or whomever, how many people he wanted to. And I made it known to him, as he knows, that in the fire department alone, there are so many Catholic firefighters like my son who perished at that site. These are people, and we wanted him to meet with us and to help us, to advocate for us. These leaders, church leaders, are meeting with all groups who deserve to be met with, and they're advocating
but
for them.
But he didn't
and
meet with you?
He denied it.
We're running
it.
Out of time, so
okay.
That's why I'm
he
rushing.
He just scratched out a sentence and said he believes that matters like this should be left to the civil authorities, which was a slap in the face and a knife in our hearts. And we remain outraged that we received this response from Cardinal Dolan about his Catholic victims who are subjected to this horrendous, barbaric, unpatriotic, and inhumane situation.
Jay, where does the money made from the 9/11 Museum go? Who profits from it?
From what I understand, it goes into the maintenance of the museum and the salaries of the people who are part of that organization. There have been complaints from many family members that the salaries that are paid to the people who are running the place are outrageous. And my guess is that they're very much in line with most New York executive salaries. How they relate to the kinds of salaries that are made by people who are working for museums in the federal government, I don't know. That's a sore point. But for me, simplicity is always a virtue in these cases. And what you have at the World Trade Center site is anything but simple. And it was because of all of the various factions, you ended up with something that didn't really make anyone happy. And I think that that's the worst possible thing that could happen. I think a smaller, in the future, if we can do this on a sort of smaller, more simple, but more meaningful scale, I think we might end up better than we are in this case.
J.D. Aronson is a professor at Carnegie Mellon and the founder and director of the Center for Human Rights Science at Carnegie Mellon University. He is the author of Who Owns the Dead? The Science and Politics of Death at Ground Zero, which was published by Harvard University Press. My great thanks to him and to Sally Regenhardt, who is one of the leading advocates for the families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much, both of you gentlemen. Thank you.
To the end of today's show, my great thanks to Jay Aronson and Sally Regenhardt, to Kiki Valentine, who produced the segment, to Reggie Johnson, who is at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who helps things run smoothly.
Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.